Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Neil Steinberg, the Chicago Sun-Times columnist, is too. He's got a book out that a lot of us who have read it or looked at it anyway very much like. And I said, what's the title of the book? And he held it up again and said, can I say this on the radio? And I said, Neil, we've talked about this. No, you can't.
How stupid am I, John?
When are you going to learn? Book?
Yeah.
This is a family radio station. It's every day, every GD day. And you use those words in the title of your book to express some measure of exasperation with the world, perhaps?
Yes, it's a salty title. People laugh when they hear it. I have a blog of the same name, which I also can't say. And what it is, it's Chicago history divided into 366 digestible packages.
You mentioned to producer Pete that tomorrow is a day notable in Chicago. Why?
It is the 80th anniversary of December 2nd, 1942, when the first self-sustaining man-made atomic reaction took place under the stands at Stagg Field on an unused handball court.
And, at the University of Chicago.
At the University of Chicago. It's Enrico Fermi. There are two things that I do as a journalist that I was sort of proud of. I asked, why was it happening here? All right, here's this untried atomic experiment that Niels Bohr is afraid is going to set the atmosphere on fire. And they're doing it in the middle of a crowded college campus in the middle of the second most populous city in Chicago, in the United States. And the answer is, it kind of puts you right back into the war mentality. It's less than a year since Pearl Harbor. They didn't want to do it on the coast because they weren't sure that the Japanese weren't going to invade California or the Germans weren't going to shell New York. And so they did it here because it was safe in the Midwest, and they were hoping to do it 24 miles west in the Argonne Woods, but there was a labor strike, and they didn't finish the building. And the moment I really love is Enrico Fermi's there, and they're pulling out the cobalt control rods, and the Geiger counters are clicking, and there's 50 people watching him. And then he looks at his watch and goes, oh, time for lunch. And they push the rods back in, and they lock them in place, and they troop over to Hutchins Commons, and they all eat, you know, because they got to eat. And they come back and make history. And that's a moment I love. And the other moment I have to bring up real quick is that after they do it, someone there calls the National Defense Council, and the code phrase for success is, the Italian navigator has landed in the new world. And we should bear that in mind when we're changing Columbus Drive to Fermi Drive, which I think would solve a lot of our problems.
So have you just done the story for me, or is there more in your writing on that?
I gave you the highlights.
Read to me the first paragraph.
Cadmium absorbs neutrons, muffling atomic activity. The cadmium control rods inside 6 tons of uranium stacked on a squash court under the stands at Stagg Field at the University of Chicago keep its atoms from spontaneously breaking apart in a chain reaction until today. I thought it was important to tell people what's happening, because you always hear that this occurred, but you don't actually know what they did. And that was important to me as well. Several dozen spectators gather in a balcony above what has been known as the pile, a rough sphere 27 feet high made of uranium and graphite lumps. Physicist Enrico Fermi orders the last rod pulled out 13 feet, halfway from the pile. The Geiger counters click faster than level off. The figures are read aloud. Fermi consults a slide rule.
How about that? A slide rule.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's so low tech. That's the amazing thing about it.
And it was so low energy, too. I mean, relative to what they were going to do and what we can do today, it was a fairly modest reaction that they were able to control.
Right. There was not a lot of heat. It's really just giving off radiation, low level. I mean, it would have killed them if it gave off too much. But it was the moment that led, you know, only 3.5 years later to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I mean, it's an amazing story of American ingenuity. I mean, if you're looking for obviously, you know, hundreds of thousands of people died, and that's bad, but it's also a story about us with our backs to the wall facing a war we had no idea we were going to win, coming up with this amazing solution.
It was a sprint, and it's an interesting reminder of why we sometimes reference, we need a Manhattan Project for cancer. We need a Manhattan-style project for COVID-19, that we went from splitting the atom to dropping an atom bomb in 3 years is amazing.
And the people, I mean, thousands of people were involved. There are hundreds of people died.
In secret.
The mayor didn't know this was going on. The president of the University of Chicago didn't know it was there.
Really?
And people were working on it, and they literally had no idea what this was. They're helping the war.
How close were they to not knowing what was about to happen? Did they worry that it would be a spontaneous reaction they couldn't control?
There was concern. I mean, one of the physicists did sort of like do the calculations to make sure this wouldn't set the air on fire. He was fairly sure that wasn't going to happen, but it was a concern that people had, and that's originally why they wanted to do out what became Argonne National Lab, but at that time was a half-made building, and there was a war on. They couldn't wait.
Isn't it ironic, too, that a lot of the people that pioneered, that developed the atomic bomb here were immigrants from Germany because they had to flee the Nazi reign?
Well, that's one of the great ironies. I mean, Einstein, you know, was the one who wrote the letter in 1939 to Franklin D. Roosevelt saying, look, you can do this. And, you know, there's a price you pay for being a hater. And one of the many prices you pay is that the people you really, you know, could help you, you drive away because of their faith or their color or some other stupid non-consideration.
And it's not like the Germans weren't themselves trying to do the very same thing, but we beat them at that game.
We beat them, and they beat us in missiles. You know, they had the V2 rockets and things like that, and it was a near thing. You know, had they not driven these physicists away, had those physicists gone to Russia and said, "Here, Russia would have had the bomb," and who knows what kind of war we would have had.
Do I recall also that it was about the heavy water that we needed, and there was a scramble to acquire enough deuterium?
Yes, that's why this wasn't done at Columbia. Columbia tried to do this earlier, and they had bad uranium, bad products, basically. A lot of the Manhattan Project was trying to, you know, uranium is an ore, it's a rock in the ground, and they're trying to purify it and make it so that these reactions can take place.
So it was on tomorrow's date.
Tomorrow's date, December 2nd is the anniversary.
1942,
about 3:30 in the afternoon.
That unbeknownst to the mayor... Wait, imagine Lori Lightfoot getting a hold of this. She gets really ticked off if you move the Columbus statue on a float without her knowing. Imagine if she said, wait a minute, what?
People were much more accepting of things the government did back then. I think before the Vietnam War, people tended to do it. I mean, you know, this was a time when you could order young people to go and serve in the military and die. I mean, it's very far from the I won't wear a mask mentality that we have now.
I've read a little bit about the Manhattan Project, and so I know some of the story, and yet your anecdote, this is what you do in this book, Neil. You'll take something that we know about, the Chicago fire, the Eastland disaster, and then you'll tell me something about it I didn't know.
Well, that's not accidental, man. You know, you don't want to bore somebody and tell them what they are. You know, you want to kind of bring to, in fact, I went to do a signing down at the co-op, the seminary co-op, and we went to get some coffee beforehand, and we went to Hutchins Commons, and I got so excited. I'm like, it's still
right
there. It's like Harry Potter. If you've never been to it, it's the dining room at Harry Potter. I mean, the luxury that they have down there. But we did it here because we had the metallurgists, we had a lot of the scientists, we had this infrastructure here. And I think it's something, you know, we spend so much time being proud of pizza and hot dogs, and they're great, but I think we should also be proud of splitting the atom down on Hyde Park. I mean, I think that's a human accomplishment. I mean, yes, it's caused a lot of trouble, but a lot of energy. I mean, given global warming, it could save us all, you know, these atomic nuclear reactors.
Just thinking that they'd need to find something from that effort and then make that a pizza or a hot dog or a micro beer, you know.
Well, you could use a small reactor to heat the pizzas, I think.
That's... Or issue a can with a, you know, the atom spinning around the nucleus, the electron spinning around the nucleus, and then say this is fermentation. And it's a fermentation beer.
That was very big in the 50s. You know, people you kind of went with that whole, the swoosh and all that sort of thing. I mean, whatever technology ends up as toys. You know, that's why those wagons are radio flyers, you know, in Chicago, because it had nothing to do with radio, but radio was so cool.
So the title of that episode, if you will, what did you call that?
Well, it just has the date. It's just December. I go through each. I don't give each one a separate title, but in my mind, Fermi is such a fantastic character. One biography of him is called the Last Man Who Knew Everything, and I really think, you know, every Columbus Day we have this fight, and I always say several times in the paper, we've got this wonderful Italian hero here. How come you guys can't switch?
His daughter wrote that book, right?
Yeah, it's a wonderful book.
I've read it and talked to her about it, and she so appreciated that anybody would take the time to read her book because she feels like her father's genius is lost. has been forgotten.
Look, science is hard. My father's a nuclear physicist, okay? And you start to talk to people and their eyes glaze over. And, you know, we had the superconducting super collider out there in Fermilab, and, you know, we're a center for this. I mean, sadly, the Swiss are eating our lunch a bit, but, you know, it's still out there. They're still doing interesting and important work. And
that's Neil Steinberg, and the book is Every GD Day, and it's available now in bookstores and online. He's going to be doing a signing of it at the Atlas Stationers on Lake Street here in Chicago from noon to 2 on December 7th. Maybe there's a date that's important in your life. He'll sign that page.
People turn to their birthdays. They tend to look different things, and I'm really enjoying how some people read it all in one sitting, like eating a whole bag of potato chips, and some people are racing. I know people who are saving it for January 1st to begin.
You said you had something striking to say about today in history, too, though. Is that right?
Today, yes. Today's December 1st.
Okay, I know that. Okay. And December 1st in history, your take on this day is
a little grimmer. It's in 1958, and longtime Chicagoans will remember our Lady of the Angels Fire.
This day in history is what?
This is December 1st, which in 1958 is the Our Lady of the Angels Fire. And maybe I should just read the opening paragraph to start. A fifth grader sets the fire, deliberately, on the back stairway in the basement. That won't become public for years. And what does it really matter? However the fire starts, the school goes up like a cereal box in an incinerator. Dense black smoke fills the building. When firefighters arrive, children are at the windows, screaming for help, jumping to escape. The flames lapping behind them as the fire tears through the building, a few minutes before the bell would have freed them all. A neighborhood school in Humboldt Park. Parents hear the news and come running from all directions, their faces twisted with fear. Where are they? A mother screams. Where are they? Parents fight the police, holding them back. A few break through the line, rushing toward the building, then stop, confronting the inferno. Let me tell you, John, I deliberately made this a gripping, kind of terrible thing. And one thing that inspired me was 2 years ago, the Tribune did an anniversary story that basically said, like, hurrah for new fire regulations and the heroism of the nuns. It's a tendency we have, and it's a human tendency. I think of it as the Anne Frankization of history, where you take something really horrible, and first you have a little mitigation, and then the horrible part falls away, and the mitigation is all that's left. And maybe I should read the last paragraph to give you a sense of that. The sirens merge into one wail. Firefighters find bodies jammed by the windows, the younger ones on the bottom, where the older ones crawled over them. Books still open on the desks. Two-thirds of the survivors are boys. 92 students die at Our Lady of the Angels School, plus 3 nuns. Another 75 are burned or hurt leaping to safety. Mayor Daley weeps, touring the scene. Quote, if we had 3 more minutes, we could have saved them all, says Fire Commissioner Robert J. Quinn. So that's a sad story of Chicago history. And there was good things that happened, but there were fire regulations then that were just ignored. And so I think when you have a terrible story like this, it deserves, the victims deserve being told in a terrible way.
Their story being told.
Their story being told. You don't want to sugarcoat it so much, you know, that it becomes a story of heroic. I mean, the Tribune literally had nuns, like their bodies forming bridges and the children running over them to say, it was insane. And it as someone who cares about the veracity, I mean, there are things that we can learn from history, but we have to confront it directly. We don't want to turn everything into a pretty story. And I try not to do that in my book.
Hmm. How do you, let me segue from that. And
that's a tough one, sorry.
I'll pause because I want myself to appreciate the gravity of that. That's profound. But I will segue from that to, how do you feel then about the statues and things that make us uncomfortable around Chicago, the statuary and monuments and things
like
that?
Well, I think it depends how they're done. If they make us uncomfortable because they're glorifying a butcher, I don't think they're doing that role. I know I have many Italian-American friends, and they're trying to sort of retrofit that into tributes, and they were put up for a different reason. And I do think that there are legitimate reasons to relocate them. You know, you can't demand that somebody honor somebody. I think that a forced honor is something they do in fascist states. And I think times change, and we change with them. That's, you know, that's Virgil. That's an Italian writer.
Yeah, but I wonder who's changing and who's not, and who should tell who to change. If you're speaking about a Columbus statue or Balbo, plenty of people, let's just do Columbus, want to see Columbus displayed.
And I think he can be displayed somewhere. There used to be a children's fountain in the center of Wacker Drive. My wife and I passed it when we proposed to each other, and I liked having it there, but it disrupted traffic, and they stuck it behind the History Museum. Statues get moved all the time. And I just don't think it's the hill to die. I think it's a losing argument that society has leapt past the 24 people who really care about this.
And do you think, though, there's a way to accommodate both sides? That is, say you leave some unfortunate symbol of our past in a public place that previously was a place of honor, but then you tell the story.
I agree. I mean, look, we're looking at the Michigan Avenue Bridge. It has those gorgeous bas reliefs, and there are people who think those are colonial, and they show battles and different than that. I would hate to see those pried off. I would think that there'd be a way to contextualize them because they're art and they're beautiful, and we don't want to be the Taliban blowing up Buddhas because they don't speak to us.
Well, then what do you make of the Teddy Roosevelt statue in New York that did come down? On one side is a Native American, on the other side is a Black American, and it's very paternalistic.
To me, a lot of times those are low-hanging fruit. They're done because of the frustration. You look at who our president was. I think people are looking for victories. I could see putting that out of sight. Again, it's not like they're melting it down. Things go up, they go down. I do think society, we shouldn't be frozen and forced to venerate the idols of the past that were put up 100 years ago.
So it's okay if we, in real time, decide that no longer works.
Right, exactly. I mean, look, there's a school in Logan Square that has beautiful WPA murals, and people painted them over for years, and then finally they took them out, and then they didn't like the way history was shown. I don't think you need to have the current cant of the moment reflected in every surface you look at. I think that we can be big boys and girls and see things and understand that it was done of a certain time. So, you don't want to just scrub the present clean. You'll end up living in some Stalinist state.
Did you see Bill Maher's piece on presentism? And he talked about how we try and usher our current sensibilities on figures that lived 200 years ago. He was talking about George Washington,
right?
Say. But it's ridiculous to expect those people to live by standards that were not in any sense contemporary.
I went to Monticello, and I said to my son, soon they're going to present Thomas Jefferson as a slaveholder who did other things. I mean, I understand honoring the enslaved people who lived and worked there, but Jefferson was a great man who helped build our country. Abraham Lincoln, sure, you can point to one thing he said at the debates in 1858 or something, but he was a transitional figure who held America together and freed the enslaved people. I mean, I understand fashions change, but we don't want to get so, as Bill Maher said, so caught up in the moment that we forget who we are and how we got here.
Neil Steinberg's book is Every GD Day. It's available everywhere in bookstores throughout Chicagoland?
Yes, sir, unless it's sold out, but they're getting more in.
Trust me, Neil will run it to your house if you need it by Christmas. And really, I recommend books for Christmas gifts. I think I'm just going to buy a bunch of yours, and everybody's going to get one of them.
The Christmas is very moving. I should come back for that, because the Christmas, it was my wife's doing. I originally, on Christmas Day, had a piece of marble falling off the Amoco building. She says, you got to do something for Christmas. So it's Christmas 1945 when the troops are coming home, and I got to say, I cried writing it. It's a tear in the eye kind of thing.
All right, then you do get to come back. That's Neil Steinberg. Nice to see you, Neil.
Nice to see you, John. Thank you so much.
Don't forget, his next signing is going to be December 7th from noon to 2 at Atlas Stationers on Lake Street in Chicago.